Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Kyiv, Ukraine, and speak with Taras Kuzio, a leading international expert on contemporary Ukraine and post-communist politics at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. The author of Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine, he joins us to discuss the confiscation of Ukrainian businesses in Crimea by the right-wing thugs and gangsters Putin has installed in the new government and the continuing activities of so-called political tourists from Russia sent into eastern Ukraine to provoke incidents that might be used to justify a Russian invasion. Then we will speak with Sally Kane, the president and CEO of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, about the latest turmoil at the Pacifica Radio Network, whose headquarters in Berkeley, California, are being occupied by the recently fired executive director of Pacifica, Summer Rees, who broke into the Pacifica Foundation's office, which she is occupying and defiantly refusing to leave. We will discuss some of the history of the recent turmoil at Pacifica, outlined in a new article at the LA Weekly, and the role that Pacifica plays in the broader public and community radio spectrum that is important for media diversity in the country, a role which may be in jeopardy if the network's viability and listenership cannot be revived. Then finally, Jennifer Duffy, a senior editor for the Cook Political Report, who is responsible for U.S. Senate and governor's races, joins us to discuss why she moved three Democratic incumbents from the leaning Democrat column to the toss-up column that could spell more bad news for the Democrats already facing an uphill battle to retain control of the Senate in the upcoming midterm elections. And joining us now from Kyiv in the Ukraine is Taras Kuzio, a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He's a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and his latest book is Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Taras Kuzio.
Hi.
And the latest from Crimea is that the Ukrainian army are going to basically exit with their families. Is that what you understand? I've heard reports.
It's extremely confusing. The reports, those reports I haven't really seen much of, but there are other reports, including this evening, where the acting president, Alexander Turchinov, has basically given a deadline of 3 hours to the Crimean authorities to release various people they've kidnapped, including military officers. I think they may be holding the commander of the Ukrainian Navy. So on the one hand, you hear the reports about potentially pulling out, but at the same time, you also hear of a more stiffening of the position. I think the problem all along has been that the Ukrainian military have not really had any clear directions from Kyiv, because they've been caught in the middle, as it were. They should have been told to either withdraw from the Crimea, which of course is not very politically good for any leader to ask to do, or be able to defend their positions with guns, which they would have a right to under international law. And they weren't given either way to do, so they were kind of caught in the middle.
Well, what reports do you hear about what's happening to politicians in the Crimean parliament who support Ukraine, the pro-Ukrainian politicians? My understanding is that many of them have been rounded up, that Ukrainian pro-Ukrainian activists have been disappeared. Is there some kind of purge going on?
Well, yes, it's going along in a whole variety of different ways. First of all, the various private enterprises that Ukrainian businessmen controlled in the Crimea are being forcibly corporate raided and taken over without any compensation. You also have Ukrainian Catholic and Orthodox priests, Ukrainian civic activists, and some Ukrainian officers being abducted. There isn't really any indication of where they're being kept or what's happened to them. And, of course, you've had the case of one particularly Crimean Tatar who went to sign up for the Ukrainian military on the 3rd of March, whose body was found tortured and murdered. So these signals are certainly there, and they're an outcome of the type of people who've come to power in the Crimea. I mean, these are extreme, you know, it's rather fanciful and a bit of a joke for Vladimir Putin to talk about Nazis running around Kiev, where people who I don't really see on the streets of Kiev, when actually the people who have taken power in Crimea with Russia's occupation forces are actually racist xenophobes and who have a vendetta against anything Ukrainian or Crimean Tatar.
Well, indeed, the new leader of the Russian annexed Crimea, Sergei Aksionov, is a former gangster nicknamed the Goblin, and the Speaker, yes, of, the speaker yes. of the Parliament, Konstantinov, is a criminal who scammed a bunch of people into buying apartment buildings that were never built. So they're a pretty unsavory bunch. But, you know, of course, Yanukovych was a massive kleptocrat. So is this at the heart of the issue here, just leaving aside what just happened to Crimea and what could happen to eastern Ukraine if Putin decides to invade? At the heart of this issue, my understanding is that this is a choice that Ukrainians have between a pro-European kind of government that offers transparency and rule of law and some economic prospects, and this kind of gangster kind of kleptocracy and thuggery that Putin and his cronies are offering. I mean, I understand the people in Crimea voted with the belief that their lives would get better under Russian occupation, at least the Russian majority did. But that's not likely to happen, given who Putin and his cronies are and what kind of economic model they're offering. So is that at the heart of this issue?
Well, yes. I mean, you have actually a gap of only a few days between what is happened to the Crimea with the referendum and then the declaration of independence and the annexation by the Russian parliament. On Friday of this week, Ukraine will be signing an association agreement with the European Union that may down the road provide a possibility of membership in the European Union. Now, the stark differences between life in Russia and life in a European Union country are massive, of course, in the European Union, where, you know, people have different views of the European Union. I mean, I'm British, for example, so we're always a bit skeptical about the European Union. But at the same time, this is a place where you have the biggest trading organization in the world, high standards of living, you have rule of law, you have free elections, free media, you have equal rights for women and men, and you have national minority guarantees as well, like, for example, the Crimean Tatars. So all of these factors do not exist in Russia, sadly, the people who voted for the referendum, I don't think the results were as high as they claimed, but what they voted for was the hope that the standard of living that they had would increase, because Russia does have a higher standard of living than Ukraine because of its abundance of raw materials and gas and oil. They hope that Russians would come to the Crimea to go on holiday. And for many of them, particularly the older generation, you know, they don't really care so much about the democracy and rule of law issue, because they're just nostalgic for the good old days when there was more stability and pensions and wages were paid on time. So there's two massive contrasts. And I have an op-ed coming out tomorrow in the Toronto Star, where I contrast the lives of national minorities in Ukraine, and particularly the reacting to the accusations of Vladimir Putin that the people who came to the power in Kiev are all sort of anti-Semite right-wingers. And I say that, first of all, the Jewish organizations in Kiev supported the Maidan. And secondly, once you go into Europe and you integrate into Europe, you're going to get many of the rights. I mean, you're as a national minority or religious minority, you will be guaranteed rights in Europe, Whereas if you are a Tatar or a Ukrainian living in Crimea and you're heading into the Putin's Eurasian Empire, forget any rights. I mean, absolutely forget any rights and forget any ability to appeal to a court or rule of law. So, yes, the contrasts are massive. And you know, Putin hired Mr. Aksyonov as his, as it were, a fifth columnist to implement his strategy in the Crimea. But Mr. Aksyonov was, until recently, a nobody. I mean, his political party has 3 seats out of 100 in the Crimean parliament. So, but sadly, you know, he's now, his people are now in charge, and these are people who are on the fascist right.
So what is the local reaction now to Vladimir Putin's speech? First, he gave a speech to his admirers in Red Square, where he shouted, "Glory to Russia," and was greeted with cheers of "Putin, Putin, Putin." And then he spoke to the Russian parliament, where he gave a blistering attack on the West and played into this idea of victimhood that the collapse of the Soviet Union has resulted in. Now, there seems to be some traction within Russians. I mean, even though they are the powerful player in this, and they're the ones with the army and the guns and the thugs, and they're moving to the West, nevertheless, it seems that victimhood plays well in Russia. And so...
This is a very old historic problem. Russia, since, you know, centuries ago, has had an inferiority complex vis-a-vis the outside world, in particular vis-a-vis the Western world. And at times they've tried to do a rapid program of modernization to catch up with the West. That was under Peter the Great in the early 18th century, and of course under Joseph Stalin in the USSR. And so that kind of inferiority complex and unwillingness to accept any guilt or of what they've done in the past, to blame everything on outside conspiracies, on outside forces such as the West, you know, it's always the fault of somebody else, has a long pedigree in Russia, and it goes down very well, this kind of victimhood. You know, the, Russia's a backward country. It's not the fault, of course, of Putin, who's been in power for 14 years and who has raped and pillaged the country. It's the fault, of course, of the West always, or of NATO, or of, I don't know, somebody else. So this kind of thing does go down well, but it shows to what degree there is political immaturity at the top of the Russian leadership and how, you know, they still think in Soviet terms about outside conspiracies. I mean, they are absolutely convinced that it was the CIA and the Americans who organized and financed the protests in Kiev. I mean, absolutely ludicrous. I mean, this is the way they see the world. And of course, when you've had 14 to 15 years of Putinism, which has led to complete totalitarian control of the media, people have been zombified by this, you know, propaganda against this anti-American propaganda, anti-NATO, in recent years, anti-Orange Revolution, anti-Ukrainian, and anti-Georgian as well in 2008. And this is what Putin has been able to use, as it were, to mobilize the population for his tirades on nationalism and to justify his annexation of the Crimea. So it's very sad to see. And it's so out of touch with 21st century Europe. I mean, this is reminiscent of the 1930s or even the 19th century. But, you know, that's Putin. He's an oddball in some ways. You know, he laments the collapse of the USSR. At the same time, he wants to live like a kleptocrat in a post-Soviet society as well. I mean, he couldn't live the way he lives in his massive palaces and have, you know, billions of dollars stashed in offshore accounts if he was still a KGB officer in the USSR. So there's a kind of a psychological schizophrenic problem here, which many actually Ukrainian experts have actually said as well. So there's a lot of things going on here, and it makes it extremely difficult for outsiders, whether they're journalists or Western policymakers to really get their heads around what Putin's up to, what's his game plan, what makes him tick, as it were. And I think they found that very difficult. I mean, Chancellor Merkel said about a week ago, after a phone call with Putin, that he lives in a different planet. And I think she's absolutely right.
But when you talk about a kind of revival of the politics of the 1930s, it does feel that way. And Putin has made a lot out of trying to portray what's happening in Kiev as being the work of Nazis and anti-Semites, when in fact there's some ugly nationalism in Russia. It's deep in their DNA. And anti-Semitism, after all, the Cossacks are the ones that were whipping the pro-Ukrainian demonstrators in Crimea, are the poster boys for anti-Semitism. But when he starts playing on a nation's sense of humiliation, that has echoes of what Hitler and the Nazis did. And after all, Hitler and the Nazis were a bunch of gangsters and kleptocrats too. And they really were able to rise into power because the German people did feel a sense of humiliation after World War I and the Versailles Treaty. So this is what concerns me, is that, you know, when you talk about echoes of the 1930s, you know, I think you could have worse than Putin. It's true that there are even more flagrant Nazis and anti-Semites and Russian nationalists waiting in the wings. But he's toying with some very dangerous stuff.
He's toying with very dangerous stuff, and you're absolutely right that we've moved, as it were, in the last maybe 4 or 5 years from Weimar Russia to a more kind of Hitlerite Nazi kind of era. Of course, you know, this is a very different. I mean, you know, Nazi Germany was a totalitarian and racist state, but I somehow doubt that Hitler was a thief and a kleptocrat to the extent that these guys are. So in Russia, it's in some ways, as we see with the alliance with Aksyonov in the Crimea, it's actually one step even worse, because it's a kind of an integration of that totalitarian nationalism from the 30s with Al Capone gangsterism. So it's a mixture of the two, and that's what actually makes it dangerous, because there's not only no limits for totalitarian nationalists to do whatever they want in the name of the nation, there's also no limits for guys who have gangster backgrounds, such as Aksyonov. And this is what's going to happen now, is that, you know, all these businesses that have been owned by, you know, hotels and the tourist trade and factories that have been owned by Ukrainians or other people from outside Russia are now going to be just corporate raided and stolen by these people as a kind of a gift by Putin to the people like Aksyonov who helped him annex the Crimea. So it's actually a double whammy, if you think about it. It's sort of the Al Capone of the 1930s together with Hitler combined. And I think that kind of thing makes it very difficult for Western policymakers to really appreciate, because they just can't believe, is it really that bad? And it is that bad. I mean, that, you know, it's going to get worse in the Crimea. I just don't see how they can resolve the issue of for example, this corporate raiding or the Ukrainian military bases without some kind of bloodshed. I mean, it's probably going to be inevitable. And these are the people who are running the Crimea on behalf of Putin are violent people. I mean, they have a violent past, just like Viktor Yanukovych, because of his gangsterist past from the 1990s, was far more willing than, say, previous Ukrainian presidents who would prefer to sit around a table and negotiate a compromise. Yanukovych's instincts were to order his police to shoot. And so, you know, you are, political leaders are a product of their socialization, where they come from. And so Aksyonov and Putin are a perfect symbiosis of Al Capone and Adolf Hitler.
Well, just in closing then, Taras Kuzio, given who Putin is and that he's all, because he's such a criminal and he's surrounded by this coterie of KGB kleptocrats who hide his fortune, and he uses the oligarchs to commingle his funds abroad, he has every reason to continue to distract the Russian people from his own looting of their treasury and yes. and his own inadequacies, because he was a minor KGB guy. He wasn't even a talented KGB guy at that. Mm-hmm. And so she changed the subject for a while. Crimea has changed the subject for a while. He's riding high in the polls. Russian nationalism is at fever pitch. Doesn't this mean that he wants to keep this going? Won't he move into the eastern Ukraine or at least keep the tensions going? As long as the tensions are going on, the less chance of Russians recognizing the true nature of how they're being manipulated.
Well, I think he'll continue in this vein. I don't think Vladimir Putin ever expects to leave office. You know, he'll manipulate the constitution and election laws just to enable him to stay in power. And he's obviously now arrived at where he wanted to be 14, 15 years ago, which is this, you know, rabidly nationalist leader, which kind of combines nostalgia for the Soviet past with victimhood. Will he move into East Ukraine? I think the danger was more a few weeks ago, and I don't think their strategy worked. I was in Kharkiv last week in East Ukraine, and I found it to be a very, very quiet, not problematical town. I gave two TV interviews. I spoke to academics and students. So I think he overestimated Russian speakers in East Ukraine welcoming in somehow Russian troops to liberate them from these so-called fascists in Kiev. That didn't happen. The protests were very small in East Ukraine, and they were usually only termed violent when so-called political tourists came in from Russia. And so I think where Putin misunderstood and still misunderstands is that he doesn't understand the concept of a Russian-speaking Ukrainian patriot. He thinks that if it's a Russian speaker, then that person wants to sort of somehow join with Russia. And that's not going to be the case, because especially the Russian-speaking elites and the international boxing champion Vitaly Klitschko, who could win the presidential elections, is a Russian speaker, for example, but he's a patriot of Ukraine. And Russian speakers know very well that there's only one free press in the Russian language, and that's in Ukraine, not in Russia. A lot of the printed media in Ukraine is in Russian, and there is a free media here. So I think there's less chance. I don't think it's all off the table. I would say 30 yes and 70 against them. Russian intervention in eastern Ukraine at the moment, where a few weeks ago it was probably 50-50. The Ukrainians are now prepared for any intervention. They've mobilized. They're on full mobilization now. Unlike the Crimea, Ukrainians would have no choice but to fight for East Ukraine, because that's the losing East Ukraine would mean losing their independent statehood. I think that Putin at the moment has pulled back and he's waiting. But certainly they're still going to be sending in, as they are, undercover intelligence agencies to try and create chaos and havoc and maybe some terrorist attacks. They're also going to be using the energy card and economic pressure. So that will continue. The relations will continue to be tense. We are going to see on Friday Ukraine basically moving from the crossroads, the geopolitical crossroads, towards integration with Europe. So whether Putin likes it or not, he's grabbed the Crimea, he's gained the Crimea, but he's actually going to be losing Ukraine on Friday. What his actions in the Crimea have actually united Ukrainians more towards patriotism and more towards actually supporting integration with Europe. Because you will hear Kiev, you know, there are a lot of Russian speakers in Kiev, and you won't hear any support for Putin here.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Taras Kuzio.
Okay, thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Taras Kuzio, who is in Kiev. He's a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He is a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and his latest book is Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the President and CEO of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters about the latest turmoil at the Pacifica Radio Network.